Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The only thing right now that really binds Southeast Asia is trade and security, which is to say that the only thing that binds Southeast Asia right now is China. What has China got on our president? What's got his tongue tied?
He's very desperate, and he's a man with a very big ego.
I think it's a PR stunt. I think Facebook is part of the problem, and they're not part of the solution.
G'day. Welcome to the National Security Podcast. I'm Chris Farnham, and this is the podcast that talks about the national security challenges facing Australia and the Indo-Pacific. This podcast is brought to you by Policy Forum and the National Security College at the ANU. And on this podcast, we are joined by three journalists from Southeast Asia. And in this discussion, we covered a range of issues such as regional security and the impact of China's rise and America's current leadership. We looked at the impact of the new media landscape and the issue of fake news, as well as the outcomes of the most recent Indonesian elections. And to add a little bit of spice, this podcast was recorded very soon after the recent raids by the Australian Federal Police on the ABC and News Corp journalists due to their publication of issues regarded as national security secrets. As well, the pod was recorded on the day that the Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte decided that he knew better than everyone involved and stated that a Chinese vessel did not ram a Filipino fishing vessel, but that it was merely an honest collision. An issue I also discussed with our guests, who were, in no particular order, Sita Dewi. She is the deputy editor on the national desk at the Jakarta Post, where she and her team covers politics, law, and human rights. In 2015, she was a recipient of an Australia Award scholarship and undertook a Master of Asia-Pacific Studies here at the ANU. Yay! And we also have Robbie Alampay, who is the editor-in-chief of Business World. He anchors the nightly newscast, The Big Story on Bloomberg Philippines, and co-anchors The Chiefs on One News TV5. He is also well known for his strong support of press freedom in the Philippines. And we have Tana Boonlert. He is a journalist at the Bangkok Post with experience covering international and domestic news, reporting on ASEAN, the Rohingya crisis, and Thailand's relations in the region. It was a great conversation, so let's hear it now. G'day, Robbie, Tana, Sita. Welcome to the National Security Podcast.
Thank you for having us.
So you've come from a fairly warm climate, and we've brought you to Canberra in the middle of winter. Mm. How's that going for you?
It's good. I actually like the cold. I lived in Canberra for 2 years.
Yes, you're an ANU alumni,
right,
if I believe
yeah,
correctly.
Yeah. And I've been missing the cold, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You're one of very few Canberrans who miss
know,
the cold.
I know. Yeah.
Is it very cold for either of you, or for Robbie and Tana, or do you find it this refreshing?
I had underestimated the cold, to be honest. I was looking forward to it. I'm coming from 38-degree weather in Manila. I was looking forward to Melbourne, Canberra, Sydney, but I have to admit I had underestimated it.
Yeah,
I agree with Robbie. The weather in Thailand is very, very, sometimes it's hot and now it's rainy. So when I come here, it's very cold.
Yeah, well, our rain turns to snow down here, so we can do without some of that as well. Well, let's warm things up now with the conversation. And I want to start off by asking you about the Indo-Pacific concept. And this is a concept that has a fairly strong home here at the National Security College with our head of college, Rory Medcalf. He was one of the early proponents of looking at the Pacific Ocean and the Indian Ocean becoming a single system because of the economic ties, largely through a rising China and its access to natural resources in the Middle East and the Indian Ocean region. How has the Indo-Pacific concept been grasped in your countries? Is this a new concept? And what are your thoughts on this, starting with you, Robbie?
Well, to be honest, it's very new. I doubt if many people have heard of it in the context of a direction or a movement or a proposal. Conceptually, people have referred to Asia in general in many ways. Conceptually, it's not new, but as a movement, the first time I heard it, honestly. Even as a journalist, even as somebody who lived in Bangkok for 6 years leading a regional organization on media, I never encountered it until a couple of weeks ago when former Philippine Ambassador Delia Albert, former Foreign Affairs Secretary as well, referred to it, mentioned it at an Asia Society event in the Philippines. And she did say, with a wink to the audience, better get used to this to this term, because you will be hearing more of it. My initial reaction was actually to wince, because I think the larger you try to capture this region, and I won't even call it Asia, but the larger you try to widen the scope, the more unwieldy it becomes. To be perfectly honest, I think even in the Philippines, people are still grappling with what ASEAN itself means. We don't even pronounce it the same way the rest of the region does.
I just picked up on that. Yeah.
So that's a thing. Then people carve out China as its own. People can make a very, very clear distinction between Northeast, North Asia, with Southeast Asia, and so on. And frankly, the Southeast Asians have a very weak concept even of South Asia. I understand it from a market trade standpoint. I think heading east of Asia and looking at the Pacific, APEC has more or less defined that quite well. But if you were to expand it further and define it heading where, I just feel that the concept becomes much too unwieldy. I understand the interest in trying to get India in to balance China, but I do have some trepidation on what that might mean, given that in Southeast Asia, what limits our capacity to really grasp a community concept is, and I've said this again and again, what are the values?
So you've touched on the idea of regionalism there, and you know we have regionalism in places like the EU or Mercosur and areas like this in the world, and ASEAN or Southeast Asia itself is a very interesting idea for a region, because you have a large archipelagic maritime Southeast Asia, but you also have the peninsula mainland Southeast Asia as well, that have very different realities in terms of everything from cultures to the challenges that they deal with in daily life. Southeast Asia, in my understanding of history, wasn't even seen as a region until I think it was the Second World War as a theater of war for the British command.
That's right.
Now, you talked about economics there, and there has been this push to move towards the ASEAN style of regionalism, for example, the ASEAN Economic Community. Mm-hmm. How are your thoughts on how that's moving forward? Is that a more challenged concept, or is that a natural fit for ASEAN?
I think the economic community is more tangible. I mean, not a lot of people are aware of the term. But ironically, my sense is the concept of an economic community is clearer to people, certainly to very influential and very, very powerful sectors, the business sectors, governments, in terms of looking at potentially a common market. It's a much more tangible concept than the concept of an ASEAN community. I think the ASEAN community is never really been realized, and it's never really been expressed in terms, as I said, of values. The history of ASEAN prior to the founding of the organization was that, you know, Mafilindo was a basically a containment strategy. This was born in the late 60s. As a reaction to the dominoes falling, as it were, to communism in Southeast Asia, and that was really the start, I think, of the germination of looking at Southeast Asia as a contiguous region. But I think it's important to remember it started out as a containment strategy. Then eventually you expand to include Singapore. But by the time it was formalized, there were no values defining what it is. Remember that this is a region where all religions are different. You have Muslim, Buddhist, Philippines is the only Christian-dominated country. You have Hindus and so on. We don't have a common language the way the European Union has, French, English, and Spanish. So we're not bound by any common. And even the systems of government, and for that matter, the expressed values of those government, whether it's democracy, human rights, transparency, governance, and so on, nothing binds us. You go from an absolute monarchy to a constitutional monarchy, to a one-party system, to, as we say, the democracies that countries tend to fall in and out of. And there's nothing that binds us. And so the only thing right now that really binds and the Southeast Asia is trade and security, which is to say that the only thing that binds Southeast Asia right now is China.
And we will certainly be getting onto that topic. But just staying on ASEAN for a minute, Sita, yeah. I remember in President Widodo's first term, as he was a new fledged president, there was an advisor telling him that he should be looking at a post-ASEAN era and essentially an era where Indonesia is more of a leader of the region rather than first among equals, let's say. What is the sentiment towards ASEAN and towards regionalism, not only amongst Indonesia's political elite, but just among Indonesians in general?
Well, I think in Indonesia, it's similar to the Philippines, where ASEAN or even Indo-Pacific is not as popularly understood at the grassroots level. So it's a very elitist concept. People don't really grasp the benefit and don't really understand, don't really know how to be beneficially a part of the regional grouping, except for maybe that Indonesian people can travel around Southeast Asian country without visa. Joko Widodo is not a president that is keen to have a bigger role in the world stage. He's pretty much a very domestic-minded politician, and he emphasized it himself a few times that domestic politics require more attention rather than international politics. But he does prioritize certain stuff that he thinks are very important, including G20 and ASEAN. So, and I think Indonesia understands that Indonesia in the Southeast Asia region is the largest economy, the largest country, and so it can play a very influential role in the region, and then it can further push for a bigger role in the international stage through ASEAN.
And so I heard the term mentioned from Robbie just a minute ago, the democracies. That's the first time I've heard that, and I couldn't think of anything more appropriate, not only for Australia with our revolving door prime ministership and what's going on with Brexit and the leadership in the UK, but also in the US. We have a very interesting president in the US that has really made some of the countries in the region rethink its relationship with the US and how it acts in the region. Tana, can I ask what impact the coming of President Trump and his administration, what that has had in the way that Thailand, as in the government, the military, but also as Thai people see the US, its position in the region and its relationship with Thailand?
I think when it comes to the US, the Thai government's They are very flexible and domestic in a way they form the relationship with the US alliance. For example, next month, Mike Pompeo will visit Thailand at the end of July, and he is going to discuss regional issues and going to talk about the Mekong, the Lower Mekong initiative. So it's like the U.S. side is trying to recommit itself to the region, to the ASEAN. And this come at the time when China is trying to asserting its role in the region. So I think from the point of view of Thailand, it's like we welcome everything, we doesn't take side. And however, the point is, because we don't have a kind of a concrete connection with the U.S., there is no contract, there is no deal. And this is because the way I say this because when Thailand form a relationship with China, it just signed a deal on the railway with China and Laos. So it's like when it comes to the U.S., there is no connection. But with China, we have a tangible connection.
And so you've mentioned China, and China is, well, no longer the elephant in the room because we're discussing it. How has the region in general reacted to the growth of China? And I want to keep the South China Sea issue just to the side for a moment, and let's talk about the Belt and Road Initiative, or BRI. This is, for listeners who may not be familiar with it, if there may be one or two of you left out there, this is the economic initiative from China where it's going out into the region with large investment packages, and it is President Xi Jinping's signature foreign policy. There are large investment packages moving out to the region into some countries that are very thankful to get this attention and this investment into some of their national critical infrastructure to help their development. There are also countries that may be a little less satisfied with the deal that they've got and feel maybe trapped into some of their debt. So, Robbie, if I can start with you, what is the view of BRI in the Philippines, and is there a difference in perspective between the government, the business elite, and the general public?
I think first with the government, they're very open to it. The mode of obviously one of the things that the Duterte administration wants to establish as its legacy, beyond the notorious war on drugs that the whole world already knows about, is a very real push for infrastructure. The previous administration was really scored, and I think rightfully so, for being overly cautious to the point of annually underspending, to the point that infrastructure really was a disappointment. And the Duterte administration has come in with a more aggressive position to build up infrastructure until 2022. And in this regard, not just BRI, but as well as AIIB.
That's the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, which is essentially the bankrolling arm of the BRI. Would you agree with that?
Yes, that's correct. And positioned as an alternative to the ADB.
Which is the Asian Development Bank, which is essentially a Japanese-led initiative with a bit of backing from the U.S. as
correct,
well.
Correct. So now you have the AIIB on the one hand, the BRI on the other hand. They obviously welcome this. As far as the public is concerned, people have been caught up by all of these things that have spread and gone viral online about debt traps in African nations and Sri Lanka and so on. And we've interviewed a lot of knowledgeable people, both on the private sector, the academe, and government. They will acknowledge, they will not speak for African states and what happened in Sri Lanka. But their main points basically come down to two things. One is we're a different country. They do think that some nations unfortunately invested in what were easy to predict would become white elephants. And their first assertion is that we are not investing in anything that is not clearly, clearly needed by the Philippines. We're investing in airports, we're investing in highways, we're investing in bridges. So there's very little chance that any of these will become white elephants. And then secondly, they point out that even our exposure to Chinese money debt-wise is only about 3% of the, or less than 3% of the total debt to other nations. It pales in comparison to what we get financing-wise from Japan and so on. So they say this is very, very manageable. The reserves are there. So that's the public and the government exchanging. When it comes to the private sector, the concern, the highest concern is not so much, I think, again, this is just based on the people we've interviewed. I'm not a businessman per se. But I think the concern more is not so much on the level of the financing or the mode of the financing. Their concern more is a confusion on the direction that the Duterte administration is embracing when it comes to financing the infrastructure projects. Because the previous administration, despite their underspending, had taken a private-public partnership track, a PPP track, and it worked. The government in the Philippines, as in any other government, is very inefficient and very, very, very bad track record in executing projects. And so, therefore, people had welcomed the shift to PPP. It also, less bureaucracy, faster to implement, and so on. The Duterte administration, by embracing the AIIB, BRI, and not just that, even with ADB, had basically signaled that now we're shifting to ODA, official development track. And that brings in a much heavier government. Again, that brings in questions about red tape. Again, they're trying to sell it as, no, we're going to do a hybrid ODA PPP where operation and management can probably be bidded out and so on. But I think the concern of the private sector is really more on that level. One sort of a disappointment that we're changing directions again. Some confusion on what is the direction moving forward. In other words, things that businesses don't like, uncertainty and so on. But from an ideological standpoint, I don't think they necessarily take a stand for or against BRI per se.
And Sita, the Chinese population in Indonesia over a couple of hundred years has had a tumultuous history and tumultuous relationship with the indigenous Indonesian population. What is the sentiment in Indonesia now? As I said, setting aside South China Sea and the issues around Natuna Islands and so on, but looking at some of the projects that China has been competing for in Indonesia, what is the willingness to look at accepting investment from China?
The government has been very positive about the BRI, the Belt and Road Initiative. The one big project that is now ongoing is the fast train from Jakarta to Bandung, which was initially was a project that was to be funded by Japan, but then the contract was won by the Chinese.
Was that much of a surprise?
Yeah, and it caused tensions and apparently probably competition between the two countries, because recently we just launched our first line of MRT. It was funded by Japan through the international agency. But the public has been divided over the issue, I think. It was one of the major issues that divided the voters because there has been this anti-Chinese sentiment growing up, especially among the supporters of the challenger, Prabowo Subianto. So they've been, saying that China and Chinese workers are invading Indonesia and that more Chinese projects mean that more jobs for Chinese workers but less for Indonesians.
So, was this a genuine concern or was this politics?
I can say it's politics, but if I talk to people at the grassroots, they genuinely believe that it's true.
We have similar issues here in Australia. There's an idea that the Chinese are coming in and buying up the country because they're purchasing farms and they're investing in different areas. But what a lot of Australians don't understand is that China is less than 10%. I think last time I looked, I think it was down as low as 3% of the foreign investment that's coming into Australia. Mm-hmm. Our largest investors are America and Switzerland and places like that, but in Saudi Arabia, and nobody seems to be scared about them buying our country and taking it back home. Mm-hmm. So these kind of issues are certainly not
unique. To Indonesia.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So, Tana, I've been looking at some of the issues. You mentioned the railway that's being invested. There's also the economic corridor that is being developed now as well. And there are some claims that some of the families involved in this that have Chinese heritage are working more with China's interests in mind than Thailand's interests. Now, I understand that public opinion and media reporting may not always reflect reality on the ground. But what is the sentiment in Thailand in terms of cooperating with China in a strategic way? And how is that received by the Thai public?
You mentioned about the EEC project, the Eastern Economic Corridor. General Prayut Chan-o-cha mentioned a few months ago at the CLSA meeting forum that it
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
It welcomes more Chinese investors. So I think the government stand is quite positive and open to Chinese business that will come to work in Thailand. However, I think from the point of view of the public, we are now like most people are more concerned about the corruption. So I think the anti-Chinese sentiment is not that obvious in Thailand.
So I'd like to make this the final question on China, as China is not the only thing that's happening in Southeast Asia. Robbie, we have just seen today President Duterte contradict everybody involved, including the Filipino fishermen, by saying that a Chinese vessel did not ram a Filipino fishing boat just off the coast of the Philippines, but that they merely had a collision. For those that have not been tracking this story, a number of Filipino fishermen were picked up from the water and saved by some Vietnamese fishermen after being left there by a Chinese crew who the Filipinos say rammed their boat as they were fishing in the contested waters near Recto Bank, otherwise known as Reed Bank, which is just off the coast of Palawan. And today, President Duterte excused the Chinese crew of any wrongdoing, basically throwing his own country folk under the bus or under the boat, as it may be. For us observers, this is actually pretty shocking. President Duterte has been so quick previously to throw foul language at other countries and their leaders and even, you know, threaten war for trivial matters. Yet he lets China off on such a serious assault on Filipinos in territory claimed by the Philippines. And I'm sorry for asking such a leading question, Robbie, but what's going on here? Duterte seems to be more willing to bully his own people than he does to stand up for the national security of the Philippines.
No, I think it's actually very, very fair. It is also, I think, what perplexes Filipinos now. To be honest, this is not something new. It's the most glaring, it's the most recent. Remember, this is President Duterte when he was running for president. One of the most notorious things he said in the campaign trail when all the candidates were asked about the South China Sea, he said, I'm taking a jet ski and I'm gonna jet ski to the South China Sea. I'm going to go to our islands there and plant the Philippine flag. And then again, just a few months ago, remember, this is the same president who threatened war with Canada over Canada not taking back its trash. And so it's the supreme irony of the president not taking a strong position, not even to personally condemn what happened, has gotten Filipinos really, really perplexed. Apart from them expressing dismay, is the second question of the back of their minds, which is, what has China got on our president? What's got his tongue tied when it comes to China? And people obviously speculate, is it the financing that we're hoping to get with respect from BRI? Is, have we compromised ourselves in terms of infrastructure? But even his own economic managers would emphasize that it's not. We're not captured by any of these investments. They are quick to qualify that the size of whatever deals we have with China is still dwarfed by overall trade and overall investments from the rest of the international community. I do think that two things that people took note of, it took the president at least 4 days to speak up. And then he outdid himself when he finally did speak up, which is, as you said, to totally come up with his own narrative that disputed not only the fishermen, but even the original version of China. The latest development was he supposedly called to meet with the fishermen. If past episodes is anything to go by, he's hoping to play the role of the father who sits down with his children and says, look, we have to let this pass, or we have to be the bigger man, or whatever. But that essentially is playing, and again, once again, risking the political capital that he has. He's just emerged from a very victorious elections. Prior to the elections, all surveys showed that he still had very, very record high approval ratings from the Philippine public. I will not dispute that. It's still at about 70%. But every time something like this happens, it seems that the president is basically gets another lease on the political capital that he can risk. And with this, it's still, you know, as you said, this latest statement caught everybody by surprise. And it happened just today. So we have yet to see, actually, by tomorrow, hopefully, I wouldn't gauge it from social media, but I will gauge it from the surveys. But we have yet to see if he will pay anything in terms of political capital by way of this very weak, very disappointing statement.
Now, you've just mentioned social media there as well. Now, you're all journalists, and I'm really keen to get your take on the evolution of journalism in the region and in your countries. Now, Australia has had a very big fortnight in regards to the media and its relationship to the government. We had our state broadcaster raided, their headquarters raided, and material taken because of government leaks related to issues that were classified as national security. So this is a pretty big issue in Australia. And we've also seen the ongoing discussion in the US about Russian foreign interference in the 2016 election and onwards since then. And everybody's gearing up for it again in 2020 since President Trump basically invited any country to come in and hand him information on his opposition. I'll start off with you, Tana. How has the emergence of digital technology and social media changed the media landscape in Thailand and the relationship between the public, the government, and the media, that triangular relationship?
I think the advent of social media somehow led to the transformation in the newsroom. For example, I work for Bangkok Post, and it is normally a newspaper. And there is an online platform. So right now we are running two things together, right?
You mean the hard copy print and the online newspaper? Yeah.
Yeah. However, the two platforms need to be different, or else why? I mean, the story might be the same, but the content, the angle of the story need to be different, or else why do people have to buy the newspaper? Considering the fact that the sale of the newspaper has declined over the past years, and therefore they have to adapt, they have to, when it comes to the online media, you have to like pitch or write a story in very fast, just an update, so that the online version can be updated right now. However, when it comes to the paper version, the editor might ask journalists to write the story in a more analytical manner so that the story in the online and the print version are different, and so that it become complementary. So that is the way the advent of the online or the social media affect our newsroom.
Is it splitting the audience though? Do you find that you've got one audience that just focus on the online platform, and so they're getting more reporting, whereas the people who buy the hard copy are different people, and they're getting journalism?
I heard my editor said the newspaper or the paper version is for the aging population or the one who are familiar with reading from the paper. However, the sales of the paper version has declined over the years, and it led to the shutdown of the Thai language newspaper in Bangkok Post itself. So right now, everything is online, but it is only the Bangkok Post that still has the print version. But we don't know how long we can maintain this.
Would it be right to say, as the older generation slowly become extinct, the print version?
I've heard it put another way. With regards to the niche market that still buys print, I heard somebody say actuarials will take care of that.
But then the printed version is going to go that way. And if that's the version that has the analysis in it, the journalism in it, rather than the reporting, does that mean that we're going to lose some of the deeper thinking that we get from the media, from the press? And this is a question to the whole panel, not just to Tana.
What we're doing right now, I think, is certainly a wave. I think podcasting
has the way of the future, mind you.
Well, I would hope so. Yeah. I say that with some self-interest. But the reality is, I think the wave that you're looking at from North America and to an extent Europe, and I think in Southeast Asia, Indonesia has a deeper tradition for news radio. And for that matter, radio features. But I think the wave is coming, I think, on the strength on streaming platforms. You know, as I mentioned to you, I've started dabbling in podcasts. I have a small startup in Manila.
Please give us the name of the podcast.
The name is Puma Podcast.
Excellent.
If you're a Filipino, you would get the pun. But just to get back to your question, I do think there's a lot of fantastic content now on podcasts, and that allows for a consumption of longer form, more analytical journalism. And I don't think it's an accident that the content that people like are explainers, not necessarily highly aspirational investigative pieces, but a lot of explainers and a lot of time that where people can have a sober, intelligent take on it. So I think it's just I can't even say it's a new format, but I do think it's not going to go away.
No, well, my new catchphrase is podcasts is like Netflix for radio. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit different from radio because we're usually talking about complex issues, and you can't go into and fully discuss a complex issue in a 5-minute sound grab or anything like that. You can't do it justice. So you've got to have a longer form. And hey, when you're at the gym or when you're riding your bike or walking your dog, you don't want to be going in your pocket every 5 minutes trying to change for the next podcast. You want a longer version. Now, other areas of social media have impacted the electoral process in Indonesia.
Yeah,
sure. Election security. I've seen elements where people are at the polling booths and you have an observer from each political party that is watching and sometimes filming on their mobile phone the vote count from the ballots that's done in front of them. So they get to see the count, and each person then reports openly in the social media how many papers have counted and what the count is for each polling booth. Anytime that those ballot boxes may or may not be tampered with between the polling booth and the Central Electoral Commission, they've already got the counts, and you know when you can protest, and you might even know exactly whereabouts any tampering may have occurred. And that's all come about with social media. What other changes have we seen in Indonesia with social media around elections, and how did the media evolve in this latest election that we've seen in Indonesia?
So the last, I think, at least three major elections in Indonesia, one is 2014, and then the next one is 2017 Jakarta gubernatorial election, and then the last one is this year's presidential election, have seen a very substantial growth of the use of social media and also the proliferation of hoax, false news.
As some may call it, fake news.
Yeah, fake news or alternative facts, whatever you call it. So, but what I've seen evolving is the society and how the society and also the public, as well as the officials, the government respond to it. So in 2014, it was the first time I think that I saw how people get fed by false news and actually believed it. And then we saw in 2017 how, well, probably not necessarily false news, but tempered facts actually brought down a politician, an incumbent.
This is you're talking about the
we're talking about, yeah, former governor Basuki Cahayapurnama Ahok brought down a politician incumbent who has an approval rating of 70%. But then lost the election after the spread of false news, basically. But in 2019, yeah, of course, the false news also rampant, but there have been initiatives launched by not only the government officials, but also by the media, collaboration of mainstream media outlets to fact-check everything and then spread the facts.
Do you think people are as receptive to boring facts than as they are to sensational false news?
But this is the thing. The society now has raised their awareness of false news. There has been an increasing awareness of false news and hoax. 5 years ago, hoax was not understood as it is now in 2019 in Indonesia. At least people on the street, when they're talking about politics, for example, one of them might say something really ridiculous about one of the candidates, and then the other will say, oh, no, it's hoax. Mm. We didn't see it in 2014, for example.
Yeah, but your question, personally, I'm not a fan of fact-checking organizations. First is I feel that, well, we're in news, we're in journalism. What are we supposed to do? I come from a generation and a school that believes that journalism, by definition, should have included the fact checking to start mm-hmm. with. That's one problem. The second thing is, as you've alluded to, any editor or any online editor, any community management editor can tell you that the second break will always lag behind the first break. And if the first break of the news is fake news, there's just no catching up to it.
That's
and
right. It doesn't matter if it gets disproved.
It doesn't matter.
Because once the story's out there, has a life of its own.
So it will never catch up. I do think this is a huge, this is a big PR stunt by Facebook to say that, oh, we're investing in organizations and we're backing organizations mm-hmm. that are doing fact-checking. I think it's a PR stunt. I think Facebook is part of the problem and they're not part of the solution, although I think they can be. And then finally, I think you have to be honest that fact-checking organizations are slave to their own biases as well. I have seen some subtle digs at governments, not necessarily my own, but governments, where you can make the argument that, wait a minute, that was not quite accurate as well, or that was framed rather too cleverly and tongue-in-cheek, and how come nobody's calling this out as fake news? So I think it's highly politicized as well, and I think it lends itself to a slippery slope as well. I do think the solution is on the demand side of information, not on the supply side. I think we just have to keep plugging away at journalism as best as we know how. But the ultimate solution, I think, is in media literacy, and information literacy, starting as early as whenever a kid holds on to a gadget. And I think in primary school, kids should feel getting an X mark. They should feel they should feel their classmates laughing at them for saying the earth is flat. This is how we learned, right? We got embarrassed and we got laughed out of our seats in school, and we got failing grades. And so I think it has to be in school. It has to be in media literacy. And people have to feel that there is a penalty when you do not know or you do not develop your own list of what are credible sources. And therefore, I think there's also an opportunity there for brands of journalism to recapture that. Because I think as we penalize the ignorant and the bigoted and so on, and saying that though there are facts on which you will get a wrong answer if you insist on alternative facts. Mm-hmm. And you will not make it to the next grade level, and you will not get hired, and so on. I think unless we bring it to that level, but when we do bring it to that level, then they will start discovering. They will start tasting different brands, and then they will start being reassured that, okay, these are the brands that don't get me into trouble.
So we're going to have to wrap up soon because I'm conscious that some of you are due on a panel speaking in a public event in about 20 minutes. So I just really want to ask quickly, Sita, while you're looking a little bit more tense than you were a minute ago, I wanted to ask you about the recent presidential election in Indonesia. Now, Indonesia is the largest, closest neighbour to Australia, and it is an extremely important relationship for Australia. And it's also the fourth largest population in the world. So we all look to Indonesia and the trends that we see from its elections. We've seen in the recent election that there may have been a bit of a bifurcation in the population, a somewhat parting into two different electorates. We've seen essentially what's the traditionalist Islamists move to one side and the modernist Islamists move to the other side. And is this a trend that we're seeing in Indonesia in the electorate, or is this just a symptom of the most recent election?
I mean, religion has been a very crucial part of Indonesian politics since the beginning. Even under the Dutch colonialism, religion played a very important role in mobilizing the masses. But I think if we talk about recent elections, religion has been exploited by politicians to mobilize masses and to get votes. And the impact is quite destructive. It's very, the society is divided. So what should be a healthy democratic process has become a battle between Muslims or non-Muslims or less Muslims, for example. Mm-hmm. It's very not healthy, and
Does that mean that there's actually a conversation happening in Indonesia of what a Muslim actually is?
Yes, yes. So I think we have to consider so many different things and trends unfolding in Indonesia when we are talking about this. But yeah, we've seen increasing conservatism in the past few years. And it's certainly been exploited during events like elections.
And so the outcome of this election, whilst most of the world, including Indonesia, sees it as having an outcome, the Prabowo camp doesn't necessarily agree.
Yeah.
So this situation is in court. Prabowo and his team are actually challenging the outcome of the elections.
Yeah. Yep.
Does he have a chance, or is this a gentleman that's just spending his family's money for his own pride?
Well, I think the experts that we talked to, some of the constitutional law experts say that he had no chance. I mean, it's very hard to prove their accusation of massive and structural fraud in election, especially when Jokowi led the election by, 17 million votes or double-digit margin, basically.
That's a lot of votes to fake, isn't it?
Exactly, yeah. Right. And I've read their argument and their evidence that they used to support their argument. It's very weak.
Does he just like spending money, or is he just that desperate to become president?
He's very desperate, and he's a man with a very big ego.
Is there any risk that his military past is going to play into this story? Now, I noticed that the Jokowi camp also have brought on a lot of military backing as well. Does that mean it completely nullifies the military's potential role in any disagreement, or is that a real risk in Indonesia?
Both sides have former generals with influence, and now it's not that I'm supporting the incumbent, but the incumbent is in the position of power and it has access to government agencies and all of the structures that he needs to defend himself. So it's probably a very small chance to win for the challenger.
It makes good discussions for podcasts, so we're at least thankful for that. And thank you very much to the three of you, to Robbie, Tana and Sita for coming in on the National Security Podcast. We hope to see you here again someday.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And a big thanks to Sita Dewey, Robbie Allen-Pye and Tana Boonlert for joining us on this episode of the National Security Podcast. There's some pretty interesting discussions that we had there, of course. China is a rising power in the region, really dominates a lot of the discussions around national security and was a big chunk of the discussion that we had on this podcast. But media freedoms and their importance to democracy is also a huge issue. I'm sure that this is going to be a discussion that we have a lot more in the future. And if you have any thoughts on it yourself, please hit us up. You can do so by going to our Facebook group at Policy Forum Pod. You can send us an email at podcast@policyforum.net. You can hit us up at Twitter on Apps Policy Forum or at NatSec Pod. So look out for the coming pods that we have. We'll be speaking to Hugh White, the author of How to Defend Australia. You can also hear from Jean-Marie Guernot, who was a high-ranking official in the French government, was also head of United Nations peacekeeping, and is now a deep thinker at the Brookings Institute. And you can hear from Kelly Maximus, who was a top-ranking official in the American national security community. She will be talking on China, Iran, and Trump. You can also hear from Greta Nabbs-Keller, Hiro Akutsu, and Joanne Wallace talking to me about how the Indo-Pacific concept has been grasped throughout the region. All of these podcasts coming to you soon on the National Security Podcast. Talk to you then.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.